Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. So it is in a it is in a position where the question is, what should this school do? What about its programs? How does this school relate to the School of Social Work? Now, I've taught in the School of Social Work and some, I guess, financial, I gave twice toward the course, financial management for nonprofit organizations. Well, the School of Social Work, the School of Public Health, there is a question, you see. These schools, what should their interrelationship be? And of course, a big factor that comes up in the university is this question of publications. And you see, it has been felt that that GISPIA faculty haven't produced so many publications. And you've heard that. It's almost a cliche now. Publish or perish. That in the university, very frequently, very often, you can't get promoted unless you publish.
I would say it's almost always.
Yeah, I was trying to be very cautious about it. And so, if you don't have a publication record, you're stuck. So, maybe what you publish sometimes just can be a lot of junk, as long as you can say, poise, wrote this book. So, what to do is that helps you. See, in my case, I wasn't involved. Already having gotten a full professorship and having tenure.
So
I could thumb my nose and say, well, I did publish two books, but anyhow, so they look at GISPIA and say, gee, you people haven't produced a great deal. And to me, the big issue there is, and the thing that I've wondered about, with supposedly training the master's degree, people to go into government, to be government employees or government officials. The PhD is for people who ultimately want to do a lot of research or perhaps go be teaching. And the thing that I've been concerned about in GISPIA, I said, look, there are very few people in this school. If we're training practitioners, I'm not so much worried about what they publish, but what experience have they had running anything? And I don't say that egotistically, but I'm one of the few who's had, well, probably my, maybe Stone has had, but this hasn't been as diversified as mine. But in terms of actual experience, I perhaps have the greatest diversity and greatest experience. But I've always said it's just like practicing medicine. Or if I'm training in a medical school, and I become clinical professor or professor of medicine, I just can't go to a textbook and say, now, gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen, this is what we're going to study. I better go out and work on some patients as well. I have to, if I'm going to be, I'm training practitioners, I have to. But I don't think our provost hasn't taken exception on that score, because he himself does not come from the practice of government. So let me put it this way. I think because originally they were going to abolish the name GISPIA, right now, and they're still working on the final solution, what will be acceptable, I think they probably will try to retain that name, because the name is known throughout the world. They have established generally a good reputation, I guess, among schools of public administration, public affairs. There were, I think, eight of the highest ten. They were, I think, number eight or something. And probably that they'll change the program as to maybe what the emphasis should be. See, because they train both public administration itself, international affairs, what they call economic and social development, how to train people to go into other countries and develop them economically, socially. They'll probably change the program. They probably will take measures to cut down the cost.
So that the emphasis will be what? On research or
no,
on
well,
practical? Application.
Well, I don't know if you have to say on practical application, because I don't see that the provost has ever really taken. I think the emphasis will be on the pure, what they call administration as administration per se. Administration, just like the School of Business emphasizes, business management. In fact, the provost had thought of even changing the name of School of Public Management to emphasize the managerial.
Mm-hmm.
They will also, there's some possibility that they name me, although one of the professors of the School of Social Work tells me they may oppose it. the School of Social Work, that some of their, what do? They teach administration. The School of Public Health teaches administration. In fact, when Litchfield was here, and I know I attended some conference where we brought together the representatives of different schools, I represented the dean of the school, of our school, Litchfield was trying to bring together, he said, well, gee, all you people are dealing, whether you're in education, whether, you see, they all are dealing some way with administration, in education, in social work, in public health. They're all concerned with administrate, with management in some way, public management. And Litchfield was trying to bring them together, but he couldn't do it because each school tends to develop a sensitivity, what they call turf. And so something probably will be done on that score. All I know is that there have been plans, counter plans. It's up before the provost now as to what his final action will be.
But it won't be abolished at some point.
No, it doesn't look that way. It doesn't look that
way. Can we continue on? Is there time on this?
We have about 10 more minutes.
Okay, I would like to get involved at this point because during this period of time, you were involved with the Indian Institute and their public administration, and you went to India.
That's right. That I would say was one of the highlights of my career.
And I'd like to talk about that.
Okay. Well, I would say, you know, and I always think of highlights. I always, as I think I told you about the Coast Guard, well, of course, the Budget Bureau, too, but being in the executive office of the president, that was a highlight. The military was a highlight. Being director of finance of Illinois was a highlight. And I would say the Indian Institute of Public Administration, because the Ford Foundation had asked me originally whether I'd go there for a year. As a Ford Foundation consultant, go to Delhi. But my wife and I had been there in connection with a trip around the world in 1966. And I was miserable in that. In fact, I was very ill. My wife could take it much better than I was. And I didn't feel I wanted to go back for a whole year, including the summer heat. So finally, we settled. I'd go back for one term in September 1970. 72 to January 73. And while I was there, they call it an Indian Institute of Public Administration, which is concerned with the governmental administration. It gets funds from the government. It also gets membership fees. And it's organized more like an academic enterprise. In other words, with the staff of it, you have people with the title of professor, associate professor. It's very academic quality. I was asked to go as consultant in connection with what the institute was doing on changing the budget system of India, both what they call the central government and the state governments. And they had a man there who had his PhD, Dr. Tabu Raj, I think he was a PhD from Cornell, and I was to work with him. At the same time, as it worked out, in addition to reviewing what he had done, and participating in seminars in Delhi, I was to give lectures. And I lectured in Hyderabad, Ahmedabad, Calcutta, Bombay. I lectured through quite a bit of India. And I looked over what the people were doing, and I came out with a paper pointing out that I felt they tried to go forward too rapidly on their budget system. That the thing was not quite realistic. This did not endear me to Tabu Raj, whose whole, at least that moment, his career seemed to be pretty well embedded in this new budget system. But I did get an insight into the, very good insight into the Indian government. And even though I wasn't there for such a long time, just for a term, this ability to lecture, to travel throughout India. And then we were sort of adopted by a Sikh family, took us in, eat there rather frequently. I got to know the Sikhs well. I really got an understanding, as much as you can, of something about the Indian situation, the difficulty, the differences, the diversity of India, the problem between the states, the caste system of India. At least I got an appreciation of what they were struggling with
This past December, 1984, Indira Gandhi, who was Prime Minister of India, was assassinated.
Right.
In view of this, I'd like you to discuss more about your feelings about the caste system and the people and how these things happen and the poverty, because after all, there is a great deal of poverty there, but there's also obviously a great deal of wealth. You were involved in financing. Why isn't this money filtering down? Also, your feelings about the culture of the Sikh family.
Well, let me say that the first thing that hits you is this tremendous population explosion. I think I once put it this way, that each year you have, in addition to the Indian population equivalent to the population of Israel, that is just, that there's something there, and the difficulty of controlling that. Now, it is true that India says it's raising enough food to feed all the people, but the question is whether the food gets, you can raise it, but the question is whether it gets to the people. The thing that struck us was this, the population, and looking at the poverty, looking, of course, I happen to be an animal lover, even looking at animals and seeing them, you know, with ribs, you know, sort of protruding, if you will, and saying, well, what is going to happen with this population? And yet you see, as you well put it, the extremes of wealth. You go and you wonder how they do it. Calcutta, where poverty is horrible. You know.
Well, how do they do it?
Well, you wonder about the unrest. But you see their philosophy. Although now, like I said, you're getting, see the idea. The basic philosophy in India is, look, you're going to go on to a minute. In the next world, when you die, lo and behold, with transmigration, if you will, that you wind up, in view of the suffering you've had in this world, you're going to make up for it when you're born again. And so, but I think now the Indians are getting less satisfied. But you have a horrible caste system, which again is supposed to be illegal. You have a terrible system in connection with dowries. It's supposed to be illegal, but it's still practiced. You have different languages. What is it, 13 or 16 official languages? The different states in India, the different traditions. You have, by the way, have a color line, because the Indians in the south, are dark. Those, and they do draw. A color. So you get this diversity of culture. You get a diversity of languages. You have a caste system. You have a tremendous resistance to change. And this exploding population presents some horrible situations. I would just like to say one thing. When I think of India, somebody said, well, why do you want to go back? I was there in Bombay, you know, on a semester at sea, and I didn't meet my Sikh friends. They came down from Delhi to meet me in Bombay. And I always said, well, to me, it epitomizes, if you will, the utmost of beauty and the worst of human degradation. Because if you go, of course, Calcutta, although Bombay is becoming somewhat like it, you know, when you go through a city, if you're driving from the airport and you go by, and first you wonder whether these are cadavers on the sidewalk. You see people sleeping on the sidewalk, and you realize that they're born on the sidewalk, they live on the sidewalk, you know, what the rest of them takes care of them sometimes when they die. She at least takes them in sometimes and do her, what do you call it, hospice, whatever it is, so at least they can die there. And so they live on the sidewalk, they're born on the sidewalk, they live on the sidewalk, die on the sidewalk. You say, my God, the immensity, what gets you is the immensity of the problem, the immensity of the problem.
That's sad.
All right, I have an article that was obviously written in the by Sarah Rosenblum in the Squirrel.
Right,
I have an article that was written by Sarah Rosenblum in the Squirrel Hill News concerning your trip to India with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
She later included this article in a book that she wrote called Neighbors, You're Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And in the article, it talks about you talk about your trip to India.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you visited an art school.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, since we have a very active board.
An art school in India, or an art school in Tehran?
Was it in Tehran?
It was in Tehran.
Okay.
It was in Tehran.
Was involved in the same trip?
It was a mountain. We were on our way to India, and I purposely stopped at Tehran, interestingly enough, because we could have gotten a direct flight from. From New York. We left New York, but I did not want to stop in any Arab country, and so we stopped off in Istanbul. Although the stewardess thought we were nuts for doing so, because we made our trip that much more complicated. And then we flew to Tehran, and we stayed there either for two nights or whatnot, and then flew to India. Okay, and in the course of being in Tehran. I forget what somebody told me about this art school. I called up, and we visited the art school, the establishment there.
All right. Do you remember what art stands for?
What is it
for? Organization through rehabilitation training.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at that time, the directorship had changed, because I was impressed with it. Because I asked the man about his background. Interesting enough, he came from. What they call, you know, in England, a public school is a private school, you know. So he came from a British public school, which apparently educated, he told me, if I recall, to Jewish youngsters. And because I was interested, why would they have a man like this in the art school? And he took us through and told us little about the Jews in Tehran, which first of all, you might be interested, he told me at the time, that the wealthy Jews in Tehran didn't give a damn about the poverty-stricken Jews, completely, and that the only thing that was helping them was the joint distribution committee. He said the wealthy Jews sort of disassociated themselves. That was his contention. Now I'm just telling you.
Where did these wealthy Jews come from originally? Do you know?
That I don't know, but apparently there was wealth, and you know, of the Jewish wealth in Tehran. So. So we went through, and we saw these activities, you know, what the training, and as I understand it, they take.
What did you see? I mean,
well, I'm trying to recall. We saw both, I guess, both the young men and young women being trained there for, I guess you might say, sort of basic vocations. But we understood, and now you know a lot of this is vague, so you have to. You have to understand this, I say. But what particularly interested me was the fact that to those who showed ability, that then they would be sent to other countries. I think you might have mentioned Switzerland as being a country. Is that right? Where they would get advanced training. So that if one of these young people showed capabilities, that their potentialities would be developed by sending them to other countries.
And were they trained for specific trades such as printing or dressmaking or architecture?
I understood they were being trained for but then those who were sent to other countries might even be trained for engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me on this, I might have been wrong, but I understood then that they would admit a certain number of non-Jews to their training. I remember discussing them.
These were all poverty.
Yes, they were all poverty levels. They were all poverty levels. And that's when the issue of the lack of concern of the wealthy Jew for the impoverished Jew. Don't forget, many of these impoverished Jews were not people who lived in Iraq a long time, for example. I think when we went to an Iraqi shul, I know it was Sukkot, because I remember very well sitting on the floor as you
yes.
in some of these.
According to the article you did.
Yeah. Is that right? Is that me?
They also attended the Iraqi synagogue.
No, how the hates that I remember.
Your memory is phenomenal.
And I remember how hospitable they were to us, how nice, but even then, because of the feeling they pointed out that there were police guards outside, not policing in the Senate, but to protect them against them. There was still an element of anti-Semitism because they had police guards outside of the shul. I must tell you an anecdote. First of all, now that I recall it, there was a young Jewish woman, very bright girl, who was going to the University of Tehran. We went down and we asked, because we said we'd like to know our way around. We had been in Tehran back in 1966 on a trip around the world, but at that time, some of the government officials entertained us. This time I said, well, we'd like to look around. And this girl was acting as a tour guide. And when she found out she was Jewish, she was great. And when we spoke to her, she told me about the migration of the Jews from Iran to Israel. And she was waiting for an opportunity to go, that her family was migrating. And she even told me that there was some fellow there from Israel in the hotel, and I think she was doing some typing or stenographic work for him. And because he was from Israel, she would not charge him anything. And I tell you, this young woman, he just was quite...
Why did she want to go to Israel?
The feeling that it's extremely uncomfortable about Tehran. See, even at that time, there was a feeling of uneasiness even under the Shah.
Why?
Well, I asked about it, and you have to be careful, you know, when in a country like that about asking questions, because then you're embarrassing the person. But and even though it was well, but I guess a feeling I recall, and yes, I have to rely on memory. It was a question: what happens if that Shah dies? So what happens if you're relying on his indulgence? What happens when he dies, knowing that there was this latent hostility towards the Jews?
The Shah ultimately was assassinated. Is it your feeling that most of the wealthy Jews then had already been able to get out of Tehran?
Well, some of them were not smart enough, you know, and some of them then started. I don't know how many did get out, but as you know, it did cause some impact. Some of them exited Tehran with so much wealth and bought up so much even that it did create sometimes a bad impression as to the wealth which they had. And I, candidly, having heard what their attitude was towards their poor Jews, I was not too sympathetic to them. I know, in fact, I felt a little hostile to on the idea that they could be so damn selfish about it. But this chap who came from Britain, you see, this new head of Ord, I see coming in, probably if he'd been there for years, he would have gotten accustomed to the system. But coming in relatively brand new, he was shocked too, you see. He made quite a point. I think of it, I don't know where we had lunch. But all I know is we had a little get together.
What were the facilities like? Were they modern or were they?
Oh, I was impressed. I was impressed with the physical facilities, yes. I was very much impressed.
And who were the teachers?
That I don't recall. That I don't recall, but I know I was impressed with the facilities.
Were they Jewish, do you think?
I was impressed with the facilities. I must tell you an anecdote. The way we got to this Iraqi shul, I don't know what I told this Mrs. Rosenblum, whatever her name was, that we wanted to go to the shul. It was Friday night, and I called down to the switchboard operator. Hotel was that the Continental or the hotel they have there? Yeah. And I said, I explained I wanted to get to the synagogue. Could she tell me how we could get there? So there was a group there. They had a big sales demonstration. There was selling dental equipment down there in this hotel. And I heard a yell, "Is there a Jew around here? There's some fellow who wants to go to a synagogue." And I could hear yelling that throughout the lobby. And the young fellow appeared on the scene. He said his father had owned this one dental equipment company, and he'd be glad. He said he doesn't know, but he'd be glad to escort us to the Iraqi synagogue. You see that we got back in time. At the same time, then he asked me what I did, and at the same time I said, "But wait, Do you think you can help me get into graduate school? He's a very pragmatic guy. And I said, well, tell me something about your background. Do you want me to send you information about it? What are you interested in? And we left it that way. But I'll never forget hearing this person yelling all over the lobby as they chew around. This man wants to get to the synagogue.
You said that you really came from a Reformed background.
No, Reformed so far as KM.
Okay.
My own background as a boy was not Reformed.
All right, because I've noticed that you do really search out places to go for Friday evening
services. Oh, yes, I do. I know. I think maybe it's...
Did you always do this throughout your career? Or just when you went away?
I'm trying to recall. I think I told you at first, initially in my career, I felt a little disenchanted. I told you my experience mm-hmm. in Wisconsin, and shortly after we were married. And yet I always felt drawn towards Jewishness, and always felt more at home. And then, of course, I suppose when, especially, I'm trying to recall now, when I traveled, I would always see, well, could I get someplace, for example, in London. I know I've been to the great synagogue, and on Yom Kippur, I remember on the way to India, interesting enough, by the time we were in India, we stopped off to London, because it's a hell of a long trip from Pittsburgh to India. So we stopped off in London for a couple of days, and it was Yom Kippur. And I remember I went to the shul there, and the range, by the way, in Britain, it's probably all Orthodox. Well, there's very little reform, or liberal, as they call it. And I arranged them to go to shul. But what has hurt me sometimes is that, although we supposedly should have a tradition of welcoming this stranger, in some cases it doesn't work out that well. Now, in the great synagogue, which I attended in London, on Saturday they will, call me up for the... When I went to Yom Kippur, and I paid, by the way, the Liyas for it. And I said, fine, that sounds seems right there. Made a contribution. And when I went in, I didn't have a prayer book. I didn't have a prayer book. Nobody made an offer. I said, well, look, fellows here. And I think we're rather spotty sometimes on that. Now, in India, of course, my gosh, this Jewish community in Delhi, they were just wonderful, wonderful for us, wonderful people. I came away, even my wife, as I said, was not particularly observant. Even she would say, well, look, to go to shul every Friday, because after all, they wanted us. And of course, it's the Jewish community in Delhi is dying. But the warmth, in other words, let me put it this way, my impression is that we Jews have tremendous potential in terms of demonstrating warmth to each other. In some cases, it's done. In some cases, it's not. But wherever we traveled, I remember in Budapest to see the synagogue. I've asked, well, how can we get to the synagogue? Whether it's religious, being so religious, or let's put it another way, maybe it's feeling the kinship. That no matter how the years have gone by, I've always felt a certain kinship, and I think maybe that accounts for it. And in some cases,